Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Hi, I'm Pete Moore.
And my name's Bex Gregory. And together, we are the co-hosts of the Entertainment Engine podcast. We are really excited to share more information about our show.
The podcast is for new and existing creatives working in music, film and TV. Weekly, we provide our listeners with information, advice and knowledge to help people navigate a career in the entertainment industry.
Plus, we have fantastic guests from the world of entertainment who share their stories with us, where we learn from their experience of working in the entertainment business, built in with some fun facts along the way.
So be sure to subscribe on your favourite podcast platform.
You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google Podcasts, plus many others.
We look forward to welcoming you to the show.
This week, we welcome to the show Jim Piddock, a well-regarded actor, writer and producer who began his career on the stage in England before emigrating to the United States in his early 20s. For more than four decades, Jim has navigated the turbulent waters of Broadway and Hollywood as an actor and a writer. Jim has appeared in a long succession of major and independent film and television shows, such as The Tracy Ullman Show, The Twilight Zone, Murder, She Wrote, ER, Friends, Law & Order, LA, Two and a Half Men, plus appearances in feature films, Lethal Weapon 2, Independence Day, Austin Powers 3, The Prestige, The Seeker, The Dark is Rising, and so much more. Jim is author of the book called Caught with My Pants Down and Other Tales from a Life in Hollywood, released on 23rd of March. Part memoir, part tell-all, the book has received some high praise from a wide range of industry insiders, having gotten rave reviews from Russell Brand, Seth Meyers, Elizabeth McGovern, Hugh Bonneville and Eddie Izzard, to name a few. We really hope you enjoy the conversation we had with Jim.
Well, thank you everybody for joining us again for the Entertainment Engine podcast show. And today we have a really special guest, writer, producer and actor all the way from the Hollywood Hills, Mr. Jim Piddock. Jim, how are you?
Good evening and good morning to me. I'm great, thank you.
It's brilliant to have you on the show, Jim. Looking forward to talking with you.
I'm happy to be on the show. It's a bit of a crazy time right now, but I'm very happy to do it.
Absolutely. I suppose, you know, before we get into it, Jim, how have you been and your family? You've been safe and well in these mad times we've been living in?
Yeah, I mean, I think my infinitely better half, myself and my daughter, are about the only people we know who haven't actually had COVID. So, I mean, we were up here in our little kind of enclave hidden from the world for about a year in the original lockdown. And we're very strict about it. And then obviously things loosened up about last April, May. So we started to get out and about more in the summer. And then, you know, work started to start up again, you know, certainly acting stuff. I was writing all through the pandemic, which was great. Like most people, it was a reset, rethink and restart. It was kind of a forced sabbatical, which at my age is actually not a bad thing. I feel really bad and terrible for people with, young families and who live in flats or apartments and didn't have sort of outdoor space. I was like very aware that I was incredibly fortunate, as was Annie, my other half, that we were at a point in our life where we were quite happy to actually withdraw from the world and just be with each other and sort out, you know, what your priorities are for the last third of your life.
I know it's been such a tough time, isn't it? I mean, the entertainment space, but just in general in so many areas. But like you said, you hit the nail on the head. I think it has been a reset for a lot of people to kind of actually look at what you actually have passions for, you know, people that maybe enjoy doing art or, you know, like writing, for example, but didn't have the time because workload and all sorts of things. I think you kind of had time to, you know, focus on things that maybe you wouldn't have had a chance to do. So that's got its positive side, of course.
And I think so. And I, as I say, I think it's very different for younger generations. But for people of a certain age, probably, you know, I'd say 40 to 50 upwards, I mean, I think we will get be on our deathbeds and go, wow, we had that year or so, a year plus, to kind of really step off the merry-go-round and actually, sort of, to mix metaphors, smell the roses.
Yeah.
To make, well, no, there could be a rose bushes near a merry-go-round. but I think that, I mean, I was noticing I'd go on my daily walk, so probably twice a day in the hills here, and I found myself noticing things about nature that I would never normally be focused on. I mean, the bird life, the animal life, the flowers, the trees, this, all that stuff. And it's very simple and very basic, but it was really lovely to actually be attuned to that. It's like kind of, it's like you'd lost one of your senses and regained it. So, so I think in that sense, I would love to put a positive spin on it for me personally.
Yeah, no, I completely echo that as well, Jim. And I think it's been, you know, a positive and negative experience. And I think, you know, to being able to reset and actually sort of take charge of your life and what you've done, you know, what people have done over the years, and sit back and think, I've done this and I've achieved that. Maybe, you know, that's a good thing. So, I completely agree.
Yeah.
So it'd be really great to learn more about your early life and really how you started as an actor right from the beginning.
Well, I wanted to be a footballer. There was only one small problem with that. I was crap at football, comparatively. in terms of being a professional, I mean, I got to the level of captaining my school and playing for London University's second team, but nowhere close to becoming a professional footballer. So around my mid-teens, I was self-aware enough to realize that. And that was when I was a bit bored at school, to be honest, and I auditioned for the school play a year earlier than I was sort of eligible to do so. And for some reason, I got cast. And I remember it was a bizarre production, but of Ring Around the Moon by Jean Anouilh. And it was fantastic for a couple of reasons. There were girls from another school in it. We didn't have men dressed up as girls. So although it was an all boys boarding school, that wasn't on the agenda. Yeah. And so that was fantastic at the age of 15 or whatever, 16, 15. And then I remember on the opening performance, standing in the wings before my first entrance, feeling an adrenaline rush like I'd never felt before. And I was absolutely terrified. I was paralyzed with fear. But at the same time, I knew it was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Isn't that bizarre? It was almost like this drug high of adrenaline. And I just knew then. And it was only later when it was a bizarre thing because I didn't know a lot about my family history because my father was brought up by an aunt. And I talk about this in the book. And it was only after this, when I was sort of in my late teens and then going to university and drama school, that I discovered that the entire male side, my father's side of the family, was all in show business. And his generation, and I had no connection. I thought I was kind of just choosing something that no one had ever done before in my family. But going back generations, they were all performers. And my grandfather, I discovered, had a music hall act with Charlie Chaplin. And I've discovered all this stuff that was kind of bizarre. So it was literally in the blood, and I didn't know it until I'd already chosen to do it.
Wow,
that's
yeah, so like you say, it was in the blood, and you know, you were following suit, really.
And that's something that's wonderful happened. There was a story that my chaplain would come back and have dinner with my grandfather, and he offered him twice to contracts to come to Hollywood. And the first time my grandfather was told by his father, who was quite a well-known opera singer and actor, he said, "Oh no, that film thing is a passing fad." So he didn't go. And then the second time he was going to go, but the money he had put aside for the flight, a friend of his got, I think, an underage girl pregnant, and he had to bail him out. And so money went. So that's the story, anyway. Apocryphal or not, it's
wow.
I know the first part's absolutely true, and the second one I'm not sure about, but. I'll believe that one. So he never went. So I sort of always felt rather romantically that I had picked up a hanging thread by myself going, and then I ended up working in the studios that Chaplin built a couple of times. And I thought, wow, how bizarre. My grandfather would have been doing this 60 years before if he'd made a different decision. And then the kind of to bring it full circle, about 3 years ago, one of my best friends had a 60th birthday. He threw a huge bash at the Clapham Grand Theatre.
Oh, wow.
And asked me to MC it. And it was a great lineup. It was UB40, Mark Steele, Al the pub landlord Murray, Maxi Jazz. And there was about, 600 people. And he asked me to MC it. And the reason he asked me was because both my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my great-uncle had all performed on that stage.
Oh, wow. Brilliant.
So it was lovely. It was kind of quite touching to be up there and know that I was on the same stage that they'd all been on. I never met any of them because my grandfather died about 6 years before I was born.
Oh, wow. Aww. But it's really weird when you sort of... Not how you explain that, Jim, but you followed a path which you didn't think anybody in your family was doing. But really, your subconscious was saying, you've got to go down this road because your family has, but you didn't just meant to be. Yeah. It's really, the universe is quite strange, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think it is partly that. It's nature or nurture. That's always the big debate, isn't it? I mean, that's the nature part. The nurture is, I think that my personality was such that I did get bored quite easily, and I knew that I wanted to do something for a living, for my life, that I really enjoyed. That's why it was, my big passions were football, and I did like films and TV and stuff. So I wanted to choose something that I loved. And my father, God rest his soul, was wonderful because the one sort of piece of advice I always remember from an early age was him saying, you have to pick a job that you want to do and you love, or else you're wasting your time. And it was great advice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I am.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got to feel natural, haven't you? It obviously came natural to be an actor for you. You've got that gut instinct, haven't you? You just know sometimes. You've got to follow that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the one thing I'll share with you as well, Jim, is quite interesting with football, is it was my passion and still is my passion, and I was lucky to play at professional level.
Wow!
But I had an injury, so I'm coming on the other side to you. So it was sort of, I played, at a really good level. I was really, quite happy, and then I just kept breaking down with an injury, and it wasn't to be. So hence up being in the entertainment industry as well. Really?
Yeah.
But how life is can be sort of
exactly.
Quite a strange thing, really. But you're a Crystal Palace fan, so I'll forgive you for that. That's not too bad.
Yeah, exactly. I'm long-suffering.
No, exactly. But sort of going forward, sort of 2007, Jim, your sort of reputation was sort of confirmed, really, in Hollywood when you sort of co-starred with Billy Connolly, Tim Curry, Eric Idle, Eddie Izzard, Jan Leaves, and I mean, in Eric Idle's theatrical special, What About Dick? I mean, what a great achievement this must have been for you.
Mm. Yeah, it was kind of a wonderful, wonderful show to do. It was really fun. We did two versions. We did one, I think, in 2007 and another in 2012. And the second one, we added Sophie Winkleman and Russell Brand, and we lost... We lost Emily Mortimer, who was unavailable. She'd done the first one. It was great to be in that sandbox, really, to play with those kind of people. And I had a lot to do in it, actually. I was running around playing tons of different parts. So I was running from microphone to microphone. It was a sort of a staged radio play. Yeah. It was called Motion Picture for Radio, I think Eric described it as. Yeah. And we did, it was obviously sold out within seconds and the lines around the block. But I remember being on stage and thinking, God, people in the audience were sort of stunned at the lineup. I mean, you would never get all those people on the same stage in any situation. And then the only other thing I could think of is something like the comic relief things or, But this was just the nine of us, or I think eight the first time, nine the second. And it was just amazing. I mean, I literally was in awe sitting there or standing there being on the stage doing scenes with, with Eddie and Izzard and Tim Curry and all these people. And Eric and I played a sort of double act for part of it. And Billy Connolly, of course, stole the show, being absolutely outrageously brilliant.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
As a policeman with a terrible speech defect. it's lovely because actually a number of them are still to this day very good friends, and some were friends before. So it was just nice to actually to get a chance to do that. Yeah, it was really fun.
Absolutely. I mean, because you and Eric Idle have been friends now for, is it over like 25 years or so?
Yes, 25 years. We met on one of the worst films ever made, which again, talk about star lineups. It was extraordinary who was in it. I mean, if you look it up, it's called an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn. And it's literally a who's who of Hollywood people. And Eric played the title role of Alan Smithy, who was a director. Now, Alan Smithy is the name, for those that don't know, that people choose, a director chooses, if he wants to take his name off a film because he doesn't like the cut of it or whatever, or it's taken away from him. So it was written by Joe Esterhaas, and it was essentially a sort of two-hour sketch about, you know, the stupidity of show business. And and Joe Esterhaas is not the greatest comic writer, I have to say. He's very good at thrillers. So this, there was this kind of a bizarre situation. It was directed by Arthur Hiller, who'd done Love Story. So the combination, and I had 17 scenes with Eric and Naomi Campbell. And and I was so excited because Monty Python had been such a big influence on me growing up. I was so excited to meet and work with Eric. Yeah. And I was a bit nervous about Naomi because she has a bit of a reputation. But the first, I was sitting in the trailer on the first day, getting my makeup trailer and getting made up. And the door kind of bursts open and Naomi Campbell kind of walks in very grandly. And she looked at me and she went, "Fucking hell, you look just like Gary Oldman." And then I didn't know what to say to that. But then she came over, sort of threw her arms around me as if I was Gary Oldman, who I think she just worked with. And then she literally, we just got on like a house on fire after that. She was lovely. And she was wonderful with my daughter, who was a baby at the time. She was lovely with her. Yeah. And Eric, she and I had the best time. It was nuts. I mean, trying to make the script work was a nightmare because it was awful. But I remember in the middle of a scene with Arthur directing it. I mean, that's your Love Story. It's just serious. And then this kind of mad scene, it was in a mental institution. And me and Eric had been institutionalized because he'd had a breakdown. And Naomi and I were his attendants. We had a little break. You know, it was after a cut and we just sort of had a break. And I caught Eric's eye and he caught mine. And without saying anything, we both burst out laughing because we just were so aware of the absurdity of what we were doing. It was nuts. you know, and from that moment on, we had this kind of instant connection and we became very good friends on the film. And it's endured to this day. And I have to say that he is probably my closest and most trustworthy friend that I have here in LA, along with Ross King, actually, who you had on your show recently. And we've had some great times together. We've worked together numerous times. We've had mad times in France where he has had a house since the 70s and sort of built it and built it and built it. And it's just a marvelous place. We've had some great times. I will tell you one story down in Provence. We were there one summer and he said that James Dyson had just bought a place nearby that was kind of, he said, the most incredible place you've ever seen. It's like Downton Abbey in Provence, and it had a helipad and whatever. And he knew James and invited him over for dinner and said, "I'm going to try and get us an invitation, a return invitation, so you can see his place because it's amazing." So James Dyson came over and it was kind of fun to meet him, even though I'm hugely opposed to him politically. But he came over and he said, "I've got this thing I want to show everybody. It's it's got to be top secret because it's just the prototype." And he produced this thing out of a bag, which was his first ever bladeless fan. which was extraordinary because you just sort of went, I'd never seen anything like it before. You put your hand through the middle of the circle and the air was coming out and there's no blades on it. And this was, you know, right before he kind of patented it and brought it out. And it was an amazing moment because I kind of thought, this is what people in Detroit must have thought, you know, when they were asked to dinner by Henry Ford, who said, you know, oh, before dinner, let me just show you something I've rustled up. It's this, it's going to replace the horse, by the way. It's this thing with four wheels. It's a thing with four wheels and it kind of goes quite fast. And so he showed us that. And then during the course of the dinner, Eric very sort of unsubtly said, oh, James, have you been playing tennis lately? Because you know, he's a big fanatic tennis player, James Dyson. He said, no, my sons haven't come down yet. So I've not been able to play. And then Eric said, you know, Jim's a big, huge tennis player. He'd love to play you. And there's a couple of problems with this. I'm really a terrible tennis player.
He landed you right in it there.
Oh, dear.
I can hit the ball across the net, but I play about once every 10 years. I'm infinitely worse than I am at football. And so Eric had literally pimped me out so we could get over there. But it worked. It worked. And we went over. And, of course, it was... You know, we got there and James was like, oh, God, he was so enthusiastic. He's you know, wonderfully gracious, man. He said, oh, let's go and play tennis. We'll have a couple of sets while the others are having drinks before dinner. And the first set, I lost 6-love, of course. And I think I may have won 2 points in the entire set. Mm-hmm. And he very kind of wisely sort of said, well, I think we'll just go in and join the others for dinner now, don't you? And we abandoned the second set. And he took me to this pool house, which was bigger than most people's houses, and next to this kind of Olympic-sized pool, and said, well, why don't you have a shower out here? And don't worry, you know, everyone's inside. So because it was sort of a semi-outdoor, it was an outdoor shower thing.
Yeah,
So don't worry. And he went off to have his shower. So I had my shower, and I came out of the shower completely naked. And then I looked up. And his wife had brought the entire dinner party round to show them a tour of the pool area.
Oh, no.
this group of about, I don't know how many it was, six, seven, eight people. I think Richard E. Grant was one of them. There I was, and I don't think that my cock and balls were on the brochure. I don't think the audio portion probably bleeped that bit out, and the visual. That was my James Dyson episode.
That's something that's you'd funny. See in Monty Python, though,
yeah,
isn't it? That's what
yeah,
you would
can
see in Monty Python.
Visualize it now.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we ended up having a lovely dinner and stuff, but there's a number of people who know a bit more about me than they should.
All good.
They know
fun.
They know all my shortcomings.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all of the credits that you've had, I mean, all of your film and television credits, I mean, including Lethal Weapon 2, Austin Powers 3, Independence Day, The Prestige, which I love that film, Murder, She Wrote, and The Tracey Ullman Show, and just so much more. I mean, even these experiences for you must have been amazing. I mean, I'm sure you've got even so many other stories and memories to share even from these times as well, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, my experience in big budget movies, generally speaking, apart from a couple where I did have major roles, I've generally done for just the cameos. I mean, I've not sort of, you know, I'm in and out. But it's independent films. I've definitely done sort of major roles and sort of leads and stuff.
Yeah.
So my career has been spectacularly mediocre in that sense as an actor, and I would never consider myself an A-lister, but I think I'm a solid B-list person, and I don't think that that colours my experiences in terms of the stories I've got to tell. What it made me do when writing the book was I wanted to make it more like David Niven's observances and even Gerald Durrell's in My Family and Other Animals. I wanted to make it as much about the observed as the observer, because, you know, a memoir can just be a fairly dull trip down memory lane or a memory exercise for someone as they're entering their dotage. And I wanted to sort of structure it around, you know, the linear structure of my career and life before and after showbiz. Well, not after yet. I haven't been kicked out yet. and so that is the kind of hangs it together. But I really was kind of tried to be ruthless. Unless there was a good story or a funny story or a great gossipy story, or I could drop a million names shamelessly, it didn't make the book, because no one's really interested in hearing my resume. I'm not interested in it. and so I thought this kind of actually has a chance of being more interesting than some of the sort of big celeb biographies where they assume everybody's interested in everything. And actually you skip through the first three or four chapters, because it's like, I don't care what their parents did. I don't care that they, you know, used to struggle to put food on the table. This, it's just boring. It's boring. I want to get to the meat of the good stories. And if it's not a good story or an anecdote, it didn't make the book, basically. And that's not to say it's all kind of ho, 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 because there's a couple of chapters which are very, very emotional. I will say one thing. I think that the book doesn't pull any punches. I absolutely eviscerate three or four people, two of whom are very well known. And I don't care. I don't care. They deserve it. And I think people should be called out for bad behavior. But mostly I'm very, very effusive about my praise for the people who I have worked with and who I love and who I admire. But I wanted to keep it completely honest and not sugarcoat stuff, but which I think happens a lot, you know. And you do kind of, even the people I'm really interested in, I read some of their books and biographies and I go, well, you know, you're actually more entertaining in person than you are in this, because I don't really care about this part of your life. It's not that interesting. So I had to sort of be very ruthless about making sure that every story had a point or was entertaining, whether you love show business or not. It was a good story.
Yeah.
And that was really important for me.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I love the title, and Caught With Your Pants Down, I think it sort of says it all, I guess.
Caught With My Pants Down actually is titled based on two or three things that literally happened. It's literally, and their stories are in the book. And it's also a metaphor for being caught with my pants down in show business and life, which I think is, you know, as a performer or someone in the public eye, you're always exposed. Yeah. And I've always had a tendency to be fairly honest. So I do get caught with my pants down.
I've just started reading it as well, actually, Jim. So I'll look forward to giving you more feedback. And it's just to be funny. Well, not to be funny, but the last few years I've got into more reading, actually. So I actually really enjoy it now. So I'm really looking forward to, I'm not very far in. I'm only a few pages in, but I sort of, at the end of my day, I just sort of, put my computer on and start reading a few more pages. So I just find reading now just, you know, more enjoyable maybe than I ever did, really.
Yeah, good. I mean, hopefully people are reading more. I love reading. I mean, I read a lot during the lockdown, and I have periods of great, during the summer I read tons of books. And certain other periods in my life I go through binges of reading, you know, two books a week if I can.
And just to I suppose really just to pick up what you were saying earlier as well, it's really interesting that partly why Becky and I started the podcast, because obviously we got with what happened in the world with lockdown, we thought, well, actually, what can we do, you know, obviously to put something back into the community. But I'm glad one thing that you said as well, Jim, is that to call people out, because we wanted part of the podcast to demystify the entertainment industry and for people to understand it more and not to be the sugar-coated where it's everything's all fantastic and you're going to walk into Mission Impossible 6 and earn a six-figure sum. So we just felt it was important to do that. And, you know, so it's really great that you're able to come on the show as well.
Yeah.
No, I think it is important to call people out for bad behaviour. You know, I think I probably would have been a lot more hesitant when I was younger and starting out my career. But now I really don't care. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was because I wanted people to know what really happens and who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Unfortunately, the good guys outnumber the bad guys by a long shot. But And people should know that too, you know, because people get bad reputations that are undeserved.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also look at, when I've started reading, look at some of the quotes as well, Jim. I mean, you've had quotes from like Hugh Bonneville, Russell Brand, obviously your good friend Ross King, Jan Lees, who I like because obviously she's in Fraser, obviously Susanna Reid. So it must be a real honour to have those sort of people behind you and your colleagues and just sharing their thoughts, really.
Supporting you,
Yeah, no, I was thrilled that I think we ended up with about 36 fantastic celebrity endorsements, which kind of validates the book just already on that level, whether anyone else will enjoy it and more importantly, buy it. That remains to be seen.
Did Ross come round, knock on your door and read it with you? Did you sort of give him a copy? How did that sort of come about?
I did. I sent him a copy. And I sent all the people that gave quotes, obviously, got sent a copy of the book.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first people I sent it to. And there's a couple of footballers too who've read it, Geoff Thomas and Mark Bright.
Oh,
Palace fans and former Palace players and Palace friends, I should say, and so they read it and gave me lovely quotes too, which I was pleased about because it means it does work for people outside the business. The book works.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
No, that's great. That's great to hear. And Mark Bright was a really good player as well. He's pretty special. He's a good player.
Yes.
Yeah, and so was Geoff. I mean,
good players. Very good players.
Yeah.
I suppose. Just thinking, Jim. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, would you say that you prefer acting on screen or behind the camera or writing? Or would you say you enjoy them equally?
Well, I don't really. I suppose I do sit behind the camera when I'm producing, but mostly I'm either writing, which is not sort of anywhere near a camera.
Yeah.
And then obviously when I'm on set, I'm usually acting. I can only answer that and have a sort of stock answer to that. And people say, do you prefer writing or acting? Mm. And I said, if someone held a gun to my head and had to choose, I would say acting because it was the first thing I did. It was my first love. I happened to, you know, done English at university and quite well read. So I wanted to write and I knew I had some ability as a writer, but that came later. I think I've been a writer for something like 35 years and an actor for like 45 years. But so acting is my first love. But more importantly, it's like a vacation to me now. I love it because, you know, for film and TV, you don't really have to do that much. You have to learn your lines, obviously, but that doesn't take that long. And it's all short segments. Theatre's a whole other beast, and that's a different animal. And I did a lot of that in my early career. I love acting because it really does feel like a vacation and I have fun and I'm sort of looser and doing that probably than when I'm producing or writing. Acting would be my choice there.
Ah. Yeah, there you go.
But they satisfy different parts of my brain. You know what? Oddly, I never write for myself, which is bizarre. They're so totally separate sides of my brain. Most actors that become writers go, oh, I'm going to write myself this great part. And I always forget. And then at the last minute I go, oh, what am I going to play in this? I write about things I'm interested in. And that happens to, you know, I have a film that's supposedly starting in the next 2 or 3 months in England about Frankel, the famous racehorse and Sir Henry Cecil, the trainer. And it's like I wrote that because I just loved the story. I mean, a man who was kept alive by this horse, a man who was dying, and it's sort of kept him alive for five years. And it became his greatest triumph. And the horse is still the highest rated racehorse in British history.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a wonderful redemption story and a wonderful sports story and a wonderful life story. I loved it. And I didn't know much about racing, and I obviously researched it and got to know a lot about it. But again, I'm certainly not right to play Sir Henry Cecil. And the person we ended up casting, which is fantastic, is Jeremy Irons, who is perfect. He's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to be playing his doctor. or the back end of the horse. I haven't figured that yet.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah.
And maybe, because all the sort of Marvel films you watched, I've sort of watched as well, Jim, where you have what is his name? Correct, Spider-Man. Stan Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe she should have Eric Idle appear in, you know, do a cameo role and it just appears somewhere.
Well, what I do is I always write the names of Palace players, Crystal Palace players, into scripts. So there'll always be a character. Almost every film I've had made that I've written has a character whose name is of a current or former Crystal Palace player.
Oh, wow.
Oh, right.
In fact, the first character I played in the movie, the first movie I had made, I played Nigel Martin, the goalkeeper.
Oh, really?
He wasn't the goalkeeper in the film, but my character was called Mr. Martin, Nigel Martin.
Yeah.
Spelt the same way.
That's really good, isn't it? That is really good. So what would you say, Jim, has been the biggest challenge you faced in the entertainment industry, and how did you overcome it?
The biggest challenge was probably the fact that stems from my personality is I get very bored and very restless when I'm not busy. So once I transferred from doing Broadway shows to moving to LA and doing TV and film, I had much more time on my hands because doing plays, it's 8 shows a week, which is pretty rigorous. Plus then there's the rehearsal beforehand, which is 4 or 5 weeks. So, you're pretty much engaged the whole time and it's quite exhausting. But when you start out in film and TV, I'd work for a week and then have 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks off, maybe 2 months off. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I loved being in LA. I've always loved LA and I found it great. You know, it suits me. But I got bored and I became sort of anxious. So that was when I really started writing. So I would say that was the biggest challenge because I didn't know how to navigate through this business not working. And I'd worked fairly steadily in theatre up until then. So the idea of being out of work with nothing to do in a city actually where I didn't really know many people at that time when I first came here was really tough. And for me, when I started writing and I got lucky and sold my first script, it was good on three levels actually. One, financially, it writing pays extremely well compared to acting, generally speaking. Secondly, it gave me a balance in my life, so I could kind of actually satisfy the other side, because I found I was getting a bit bored when I was acting on set. I would be like, the director's got a much more interesting job. This is quite yeah. boring because we're here yeah. for a 12-hour day and I'm acting for an hour and sitting around for 11 hours. So that didn't, again, for someone who gets bored and restless, that wasn't great. So it fulfilled that and it filled my day. Writing filled my day when I didn't have anything on the calendar because you can't, an actor out of work can't act. I mean, you can't just act in your living room.
No, you can,
but it's really sad. A one-man show for your cat,
exactly.
It doesn't work.
Not quite the same, is it?
Exactly. No. The cat will walk out within 2 minutes.
I think you'd be divorced as well. I don't think your wife would hang around.
Exactly. And the other thing, the last thing, I did say three, so I've got to come up with a third now. The third thing is that psychologically, it was very, very useful for me. It was very good because it balanced my psychological kind of well-being. So that was the biggest challenge, I'd say, that I overcame. And it helped me, whilst I think at times it probably distracted me from a singular focus on acting, it really helped my career and otherwise. And it helped me get through the lean times as an actor, which I don't know how I'd have navigated without writing.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think, I suppose really that sort of leads me on to as well, Jim, what would you say the biggest difference is from the UK to Hollywood for actors? Is there, from coming from the UK to the States, what sort of
difference? Well, it's a much bigger pond, obviously. It's a bigger pond. The stakes are higher. In terms of the bullshit involved, it's exactly the same. In fact, I find in some ways Hollywood bullshit easier because it's just sort of out there and in your face, and you know what people are saying. But in England, it's sort of like everyone's so polite and no one quite says no.
No.
It's all a bit, and then nothing gets picked up and there's no follow through. I find that frustrating, and that's doing business in England sometimes. I mean, sometimes it's easy. So that's the big difference. I mean, I think for British actors coming here, they either take to it right away and love it, and or they find it very tough. I mean, it's very isolating. And if you are someone who has a sanity structure that involves, you know, where you were raised and born, it's very difficult. I mean, I was okay with it because I think probably because I came when I was young enough. I think I was 24 when I came to America.
Yeah.
And so I kind of got to the point of no return once I'd had, you know, relationships and children and houses and stuff. So it was easier for me. And I always did love LA. I never felt quite at home in New York. I loved it, but I never felt like this is my home. I prefer London as a city, to be frank.
Yeah.
But I loved LA. I loved California passionately. And so I felt comfortable here. But I've known many actors, successful ones. I mean, people like Chris Eccleston who came out here for a while and just didn't hated it. You know, he didn't know how to sort of...
Yeah,
it's very can be very isolating because you have to drive everywhere and unless you kind of have a neighborhood where you know people, it's you have to go out of your way to see people and stay in touch. So I think people either just, you know, they take to it like a duck to water, or they just want to go back and come in and out when they're needed.
It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think just sort of a real observation from me, Jim. We had a guest on the show a little while ago, Hollywood agent, and he worked with sort of Michael McIntyre and Rob Brydon, and he made a really interesting comment of, he didn't say the agent is dead, but he said the agent is, even though he was an agent and a manager, he was finding that they're getting a bit more removed on the fact of that he was finding that some big actors and just general normal actors are not really engaging with their agent so much and just engaging an attorney and a publicist. So it'd be, I suppose, really good to get your take on that, really.
Yeah. Well, I think that's always been true for A-list actors. I mean, I way back when I my paths in life crossed with Dustin Hoffman, I think he just had a lawyer and I think that was it. I think his lawyer did all his deals. And I think a number of A-list celebrities just had a lawyer and possibly a business manager to manage their finances and do their taxes.
I suppose that's all you need, really, isn't it?
You don't need someone to be hustling work for you. I mean, you might need a publicist now and again to promote something, but that always made sense. I think the manager came about because the agents just became facilitators. You know, they just became sort of, they did the deal, but then they made the submissions. But no one was really, you know, personally looking after. Very few Hollywood agents were. I mean, it was a bit different in New York. They're a little bit more in the theatre and in the book world. Agents are much more about the creative side of it, and they kind of are closer, I think, I found. But in Hollywood, it's just doing the deal, and that's about it, you know. So managers became necessary because actors in the middle of the pack, you know, upper middle class actors like myself, needed a bit of extra kind of help and someone who would return their calls in less than, you know, 48 hours.
Or if at all, there was time
at ICM when it was, there were certain agents, it was notorious. They just never return calls and they just didn't want to deal with actors. And then other smaller agencies were lovely. You could walk in and they'd be happy to see you whenever you came in. So I think managers took over. And I think now, I mean, for example, I don't have a literary agent in the United States. I have one in the UK. My manager just handles all that because I found that every film or TV show I've had made has been at a time when I was between agents. And I went, well, this is brilliant because A, I don't have to pay another 10% commission.
Yeah.
And B, it proves that I'm getting most of this stuff done myself. So why do I need them? You know, and I think agents can be useful and can do a great job, and they can certainly set up meetings and things. And there are times when I really do want an agent and have sought that representation because I need to go out and set up pitch meetings or whatever. And I'm prepared to forego the 10% for that. But the lawyer, I mean, my lawyer, I've always said that my lawyer earns his percent more than anybody else in many ways.
Yes.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, oh, yeah,
because if the deal is not right at the end of the day, that's where things can all go wrong down the line. So
contracts
is key, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's only 5%. That's why I'm saying it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a bargain then.
Bargain basement.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what advice would you give, Jim, to any sort of new budding actors coming into the industry today? What would you sort of give them?
Be a footballer.
do something else.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I know so many people go, you know, oh God, you know, I wouldn't enter the business today. I just not the same as it used to be. And I don't feel that way. I think in many ways it's possibly more of a rat race and crowded than it's ever been, because everyone and anyone thinks the same with writing, thinks they can write something or they can be an actor. My advice would be, it hasn't really changed since I was young, I would say, get formal training. Start if you can in the theater, because most of the actors I know in the US and the UK who have had long, steady careers, which is all most of us ever wanted, is not necessarily fame or fortune. Well, fortune, yes. It was to have a long career. And almost every actor I know that's had that was theater trained. Yeah. Or started in the theatre, because it gives you a sort of framework and a grounding that propels you through the rest of it. And a fallback, if things aren't going well in film or TV, you can always go off and do a play.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that from a practical point of view. But my biggest advice would be, I have a theory that we've been through the industrial age and we are still in the technological age, obviously. I think that we are now, socially speaking, in the entrepreneurial age, and people now in their 20s will not have one or two careers like my generation did, which is mostly actually my generation. It's one career. You do that for 45 years, then you retire and you get your watch and you do nothing except play golf and watch television and die. But I think now people in their 20s, I mean, we'll have probably 4, 5, possibly even 6 careers. I think we are in an entrepreneurial age. Mm-hmm. And I even see it with my daughter, who's already on her 3rd career and doing very well at it. And it's completely different from the other two, which were in themselves very different from each other. I think that's really how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And so within show business, I would advise people to... I know being an actor or being a writer or a director, it takes singular focus to do that one thing and get successful at it. But I think you have to have a plans B, C, D, and E within show business. So I sort of have made a much bigger living out of writing and producing in terms of financially than I have out of acting. I've had a nice career acting. I've made some nice salaries, but it sort of what really pushed me over the top was the other thing, and that's one aspect, that's just the financial, but also in terms of your engagement, it's much more exciting. That's why you see so many successful actors wanting to direct or produce or write or whatever. It's more well-rounded. So I think if I was talking to people at a drama school, and by the way, my book is, someone said, called it the best drama student's Bible that's been written. It's because it really is, with lots of swearing, it tells you how to navigate the business. And in a sort of hopefully a lighthearted and humorous way. But I would say that those are the things that I would give. And then on a personal level, apart from being entrepreneurial and being a self-starter, I mean, my career in the States started because I decided to do a one-man show that I'd seen in England, and I persuaded the writer to let me do it in America if I could find a producer stupid enough to agree to do it, because it was a play about a soccer goalie playing a game for an hour and a half, and no one at that time in 1981 knew what soccer was in America. Basically, it was just
no.
And so I got rejected by every theater in San Francisco where I first started my first year. And then a play fell out in the first play of their season. And they said, one theater said, who'd rejected me, said, can you get your one-man show together? in a month. And I found a great director, and we did. And that, the show went on, and it was hair-raising, but it propelled me. The success of that show propelled me to be within a year, just over a year, maybe close to 18 months, I was starring in a Broadway show.
Mm.
From nowhere. I'd gone from zero to being in a hit Broadway show. And that was totally about being entrepreneurial. Totally about that. If I'd not done that one-man show, I don't know where I'd be now. I have no idea. So I would say that. The other thing is, on a personal level, confidence. Confidence. Some people are born with it. Some people acquire it. And somehow people have it thrust upon them, to misquote Shakespeare. Confidence. If you can fake being confident, even better. But that's, I would say, is a big thing. Self-belief and not taking, although I still do, not taking rejection personally was the advice I was always given early on. Because it's not, every rejection is not personal. It's business. It's, you know, it's nothing personal. But it's very hard not to. And I admit I still do sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all human beings, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah.
Well, I'm not, but speak for yourself. Yeah.
No, I know. I hear what you're saying. I mean, because my background, I come from the entertainment world, performer side of things, but I was a professional dancer for many years. And, you know, I come from the stage background, so musical theatre. So I hear what you're saying, how being on stage and the audition process. And yeah, you do have to be quite thick skinned, I think, to be in this business. But you've got to sort of pick yourself back up again. You know, you're not going to get every audition, like you say. It could be down to the way you look, your hair colour, your height. You know, it could be things that you don't realize. It's not always down to talent, is it, sometimes, Jim?
It's always those first things you mentioned. I mean, talent, there's a lot of people that have talent, or enough talent, you know. And what is talent anyway? Sometimes I think it's just energy. But talent is, you know, it's 10% of it. There's tons of people with talent. I think hard work and discipline are a larger percentage. I think that's probably 30%. And then I'd say 60% is luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right time. You know. Right time. Yeah. Right place sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And for a bit of fun, Jim, what we wanted to ask you is, what three people would you go on holiday with, and where would you go?
That'd be interesting. Well,
God, where would I go? Well, there's so many places that are on my bucket list. I love France and Italy, and I've been there a lot, so I'd always go there.
Okay.
But I've never been to New Zealand or Australia, and Annie and I are planning to go there at the end of this year. So that would be high on my list. But the list is endless, so I won't bore you with places places I haven't been.
Yeah.
Who would I go with? The correct choice would be to say my infinitely better half, Annie, and my daughter, Ali.
Yeah.
But that's only two, so we'll rule them out. They're gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another person I've spent many holidays with, a great friend of mine, who's one of the four people that saved Crystal Palace, Steve Browett, who owns Far Vintners, the huge wine importing company.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Steve is a great friend, and he has, you know, kindly invited us, Annie and I, to go on many of his family holidays. And so we've been on many places together. So he's always great to go on vacation with, and his family. But there's too many of them. He's gone. So that's not three. So they're out. They're ruled out. So I'm going to throw something at you, which sounds very impulsive and totally just because it happened recently. I watched a show on television, which I'd never seen before. I think it was when I was back in England at Christmas, called Gordon, Gino and Fred.
The
two chefs and the maitre d'.
Hilarious.
And I really loved it. You know, obviously I loved the trip with Coogan and thingy, but I really loved it. And I think if I was to choose to go somewhere, first of all, I would trust them to pick somewhere interesting. Mm. So that would be good. And God, the food. If you went with them, the food would be fantastic.
It'd be amazing.
It'd be amazing,
You'd spend most of the time laughing. And so where's the downside? I think that all three of them seem like people you'd want to hang out with. Mm. I could talk football with Gordon. I love Italy, so I could, you know, wallow in Italy.
Gino.
And I'm absolutely in love with France too. And so I know it very well. So
Lots in common. Yeah,
exactly. So I would choose those fellows.
So maybe we should reach out.
If they're listening to this, yeah, invite me on the next one.
Yeah, I think we'll want to come, I think.
And I'll tell you what, a great podcast would to get Jim back, hosting it with us, and get Fred, Gordon and Gino on. Maybe, I don't know if we could manage that. I'm not sure.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. except they'll say the thing that has often been said, who the fuck is Jim Piddock? We did a commercial campaign when we were doing What About Dick? You know, you got Russell Brand, Billy Connolly, Tim Curry, Eric Idle, Eddie Izzard, Jane Leaves, Tracy Ullman, Sophie Winkleman, or Emily Mortimer, and then me. And so we did little spots for each person. And I said, because I've been a character actor in my little spot, I my whole life I've been a character actor, so a disguise actor, because I've always loved the idea of not being myself, and now it's the opposite. I just want to be myself. I said, so the problem is that no one knows who the fuck I am, and so they titled my little commercial that went on YouTube as "Who the fuck is Jim Piddock?" which I always loved, and that was an alternate title for the book, but I didn't think it was very good, because if my name's not going to sell, if my name's not going to sell the book anyway, don't do it twice, you know, the title and by.
Anyway. Brilliant.
And I mean, I suppose one other thing as well, Jim, what if you could have a chance to play another character or be in a franchise today, what character would you like to play and what franchise would you be in?
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, that is a good one. Well, I would love to have been in the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
And I might be one of the few actors that hasn't been.
I was going to say,
Star Trek. Never been in Star Trek.
Star Trek.
Game of Thrones. Yeah. Another one I was never in.
Didn't
really watch it though, to be honest. But yeah, that would have been great to do something in the Harry Potter movies. That would have been fantastic, and I'd have been rather good.
Yeah, I could see you in that, actually.
And the casting people of The Crown always said to my agents, oh, we must get Jim on the show. He's perfect for this, The Crown. He's perfect. Yeah. And I'm still waiting for the call. So, any of those would be good. I mean, I do say in the book at the end, I kind of assess my career with brutal honesty, saying I've had a spectacularly mediocre journeyman career, but I've survived. You know, I'm like a footballer who's played 500 league games and lasted for 18 years and done it. And at the highest level and at the lowest level, I've actually played in the Premier League many, many times to spin the metaphor.
Yeah. But
I say I've had a way more varied career than I imagined when I set out, way more. But the one thing I've not ever done, bizarrely, is I've never been a regular character on a long-running series. I've played arcs of characters for five, six, seven episodes or whatever. But I've never done something over a period of time where you get to really live with a character for a long time. And that would be kind of fun, because I was always, you know, changing role, putting on wigs and changing my look and doing stuff, which is part of the fun of acting. So that would be kind of a fun thing to do.
Well, I think I think that would be good. And I think just from a consumer perspective as well, Jim, I think the way Netflix and all the other streaming platforms have gone, I actually really now enjoy watching telly, but now I find it, I look forward to watching stuff. So when there's a series that comes on I really like, I will watch the whole lot in a couple of days. And you really sort of get involved in that character or that show. And what do you think, Bex? Do you like that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, well, we've got this sort of ability now to be able to sort of binge watch. Do you know what I mean? You don't have to sort of wait, you know, till next week always. Yeah. You know, you can just watch them over 3 days or something if you wanted to, if you've got the time.
Yes.
I think it kind of opens your eyes up to... Yeah, it's so much choice. I find there's just so much choice.
There is a lot of choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm actually almost glad I didn't do that earlier in my career, because you can get, especially in Britain, if you are recognizable as a character, say, on a sitcom. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not much you can do after that except panto.
No, no.
True. I mean, some people transcend it. Obviously, Martin Clunes and various other people, Martin Freeman. I mean, I have a friend who was, but maybe I shouldn't tell the story. But I have a friend that was on a very, I won't mention any names or the series, mm-hmm. but he was on a very well-known popular series, mm-hmm. Right out of drama school, almost within a year or two. And he was suddenly jettisoned to this sort of very recognizable. And, mm-hmm. you know, for the last, I don't know, 35 years or so, 30 years, he's basically just, it's panto or nothing, you know.
Really? Yeah.
It's panto commercials or nothing. I mean, it's very difficult. That's very tough.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm glad it didn't happen early in my career. Yeah. So now it would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
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 I could definitely see in Harry Potter though. Definitely.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, I was actually in a film that was sort of Fox's 20th Century Fox wanted to do their version. It was called The Dark is Rising, based on a series of books. And they wanted it to be, you know, that kind of a franchise for them.
Yeah.
And I would have been. I was cast as one of the four immortals. It was me, James Cosmo, you know, the lovely Scottish actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Francis Conroy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Ian McShane.
Oh, wow.
And the four of us were the four immortals.
Brilliant.
So if that had become and it wasn't a success, it was okay, the movie, but it didn't catch. So there was no sequels but that would have been a long running, and that would have been really fun. I had such a good time working with James Cosmo, and I were kind of the comedy double act in it.
He's great, isn't he?
he was wonderful. We became great, great friends after that.
Yeah, he's great. I could. Shame they're not doing any more Harry Potter, but
I know.
You never know. I don't know.
No.
Who knows?
Yeah. Well, last of all then, Jim, where can our listeners find out more about your new book? Tell us more.
Well, it is being released. It is available to buy as a paperback, ebook, or audiobook on March the 23rd. It is the ebook you can order right now. The audiobook and paperback you can order from March the 13th. If you have ever used Amazon, which I'm sure everybody listening to this has used Amazon, you can get the book there or pre-order it there. But it'll also be on any, I think it's on Barnes & Noble, all the major places to buy books. And as I say, there are the three formats. I've just finished recording the audiobook, which was quite hard work, I've got to be honest. It's exhausting. But that was fun. I enjoyed doing that. So that's being edited right now. So that will be available to pre-order along with the paperback on March 13th. So yes, anywhere. The publisher is Dart Frog Books. So their website, you could go to Dart Frog Books, based in Vaughan. Otherwise, it's the easiest is obviously Amazon. Mm. That's where I get all my books.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're excited to delve more into the book.
Well, I've just started. I'm not very long in. I'm probably a few pages. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing some more reading at the weekend, actually.
Yeah.
Well, you've got a free copy, so you have to buy one.
Exactly. I will.
Or buy the audiobook.
Yeah, actually, that would be good.
I'm actually going to say, I've got a friend of mine that I stay with in London. He's massively into audiobooks. He just constantly loves them. And Rupert, you know, has his headphones on, and he's just constantly into audiobooks.
Yeah, they're very, very popular.
Yeah, some people prefer that. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't, but I think I would. I think I would quite enjoy that, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Jim, for joining us today. We've thoroughly enjoyed speaking to you.
No, not really. He's a Crystal Palace fan. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, Caught with My Pants Down and Other Tales from a Life in Hollywood. It will change your life.
Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine. And thanks for listening.
Join us again next week for more great guest interviews from the world of entertainment. It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so please drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show. And remember to all stay safe. The Entertainment Engine.